Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Most gracious Emperor, all of us have been entrusted with the Word of God. As princes, we are eager for political unity, but not at the price of our faith. What you call differences, we call the heart of our faith. What you call heresy, we know to be the truth. We will not yield.
I command your allegiance.
You cannot command our conscience.
We will continue in our faith, no matter what may happen. We testify to the gospel of Jesus Christ, by whose blood we are free Christian men, free now and free forever. Amen.
Amen.
That's a scene, the Augsburg scene from the 1953 movie Martin Luther. The men standing there who were pledging their lives to make confession of this faith, the faith that eventually comes to be called the Reformation, they were princes, and among them were two of Luther's princes, one a currently serving prince and the other one a future prince. And of course, there was the famous one when Luther was in all his trouble. It was Frederick the Wise that protected Luther. All of them did to a certain degree. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Issues Etc., Reformation Week continues on this Thursday afternoon. We're walking through Luther's inner circle. We've come to Luther's princes, Frederick the Wise, John the Steadfast, and John Frederick. Pastor Paul McCain joins us to talk about these three princes of Saxony. He's publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House, based in St. Louis, and general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Paul, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, great to be with you, and I'm just thrilled to talk about three of my biggest heroes.
Let's kind of put it in perspective here, if we could, to begin with, because the Reformation is not only a theological event, it is a political event, almost equally in the sense of kind of the human aspect of it. Had Luther and the other reformers not enjoyed the protection, maybe even we could say the support of these princes that we're going to talk about today, would the Reformation, at least humanly speaking, would it have been what it became?
Absolutely not. What happened to John Huss at the Council of Constance a little over 100 years before Luther showed up would have happened to Martin Luther. He would have been hauled into a imperial diet or conference of some kind, and he would have been burned at the stake as a heretic. That's actually what they intended to do with him.
Who, when we say princes, most of us picture guys walking around with crowns on their heads, something like that. What was a German prince in this time?
Well, yeah, even the word prince is a bit misleading, because to us that implies they are princes in line of succession to a particular king. It's just an English word we use, but in their own day, they were referred to as either an elector, like Frederick the Wise was, or a duke. These are all names we give to these German rulers of relatively small territories. Now, I say that with some hesitation, because the size of their individual territories throughout what we might recognize today as, broadly speaking, Germany, varied in size. I mean, they shrank and they grew depending on which battle they won or whose territory they took. Germany at the time, and well before the Reformation, was a patchwork quilt of territories. I mean, if you've ever seen an American congressional electoral circuit map of a state, that's kind of what Germany looked like. It looked like somebody gerrymandered it all over the place. So they were rulers of their local territories. There was not yet one king over the entire country of Germany. In fact, the nation of Germany did not exist. It was a collection of these territories.
We're going to begin with Frederick the Wise. Why the honorific for this prince of Luther's?
Yeah. You think it's kind of amusing to us to hear these little nicknames, you know, the wise, the steadfast, the magnanimous. But in Frederick's case, he received this because he was incredibly wise. In fact, I think I might choose the word shrewd, very shrewd. He was very careful, very cautious. He knew how to play the diplomatic game to his advantage wonderfully. But he was well known, even in his own time, as a very wise man. He was much more powerful than many of us were raised to realize. He actually, at one point, almost became the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which was a collection of land, basically, through the center of Europe, most of which was what we would know today as Germany. But he was skillful in the art of diplomacy, and the way he handled the whole Reformation crisis was nothing short of amazing.
So tell us about him. How would you begin his general biography? And then, of course, what we focus on this week is his involvement in the Reformation.
Sure, very quickly. He was born at the castle in Torgau, the Hartenfels Castle. You can still walk around in it today. He was born in 1463, and he died at one of his hunting lodges in 1525. So he lived 62 years, and he had a very long reign as elector or ruler of the territory of Saxony known as Electoral Saxony. And this gets a little confusing, but basically, when his father died, he became elector of the lands that his father was ruling. And his grandfather and his great uncle had divided Saxony at the time into two parts, the Ernestine line and the Albertine line. One was called Electoral Saxony, one was called Ducal Saxony, and Frederick the Wise ruled Electoral Saxony. The reason he was called an elector is because he was part of a group of eight men who would elect the Holy Roman Emperor, and this was, of course, a very powerful position. And he ruled this area of Saxony until his death, and then his brother John took over, and then John's nephew, Frederick the Magnanimous, took over after him. Maybe we can talk about why he was so wealthy. He had a huge stake, and his whole family always did, but Frederick, of course, being very wise and very shrewd, managed it very well, but he had an incredible stake or a share in silver mines in mountain ranges in the territory of Saxony. Now, mountains to us, you know, Rocky Mountains, no, just very large hills in many cases. But this brought in tremendous wealth to Frederick the Wise and his Ernestine Saxony line.
So he's a wealthy man. He's a politically powerful as one could get in terms of the empire, except save the emperor himself, probably, or the pope. And how would you describe his relationship to Luther? How did that, I mean, Luther begins as a professor? Well, initially maybe even a student at one of the universities that Frederick was a patron to. Is that correct?
Yeah, Frederick's desire was to found and fund a university in Wittenberg to rival that of the one in Leipzig. He wanted to be a major player. He was a very well-educated man. We know he read Latin, of course, as well as German. He funded this university. He also poured a lot of money into the castle church complex in the city of Wittenberg. And Wittenberg was then, and even today in comparison to most German cities, a very small town, kind of in the middle of nowhere in Germany, north of basically any place that mattered. But it was this little town that Frederick chose to kind of make his crown jewel in terms of really putting his stamp on Europe. So he funded this university. We should also say, you've got to understand about Frederick the Wise, that he was a very devout Roman Catholic, and perhaps he's most famous, aside from all his association with Luther, for his passionate interest in collecting relics. Relics were objects associated with the saints, perhaps bits and pieces of their, frankly, corpses, a little bit of bone here, a little hair, or something like this, or something they allegedly had touched or had been closely associated with them. At the height of his relic collecting power, he had over 19,000 relics, and they were put on display regularly in the castle church in Wittenberg. And supposedly a person who would view them reverently could get 2 million years off of purgatory. It's interesting. I taught Bible class last week at my church, and we talked about relics, and I actually read kind of a period catalog of the relics, and people just began to laugh because it strikes our modern ears as crazy. But in the defense of pious Christian people, I kind of stopped myself. I said, I know we're all laughing. I said, but we really need to understand how seriously the people at this time took this. And I said, for instance, today, when a loved one dies, do any of you have a lock of hair? Do any of you hesitate to clean out the closet of your deceased spouse or loved one? I said, we keep relics. We cherish relics. We go to Springfield, Illinois to see the relics of Abraham Lincoln. I said, so you've got to kind of moderate what strikes us as just absurd with an understanding that these people, these holy saints, were considered precious to the people. And we might say they were naive, but they lived in a less historical time. And so they actually believed that this beautiful reliquary contained a part of the cross, or one of the nails, or one of the thorns from the crown of thorns, or, you know, so you have to kind of put this in context and understand, yeah, people were could be skeptical, but for the most part, pious Roman Catholics in these days, and even to this day, regard these objects as genuine and real. Of course, the problem was, with the relics came the theory that if you gazed on these relics, you would receive an indulgence from punishment and purgatory, and that's a whole separate subject in itself, but basically that's what kicked off the Reformation. Now, Todd, I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question, what was his relationship to Luther? Let me tell you an interesting fact. To our knowledge, and even people at the time said, at no point did Frederick the Wise ever personally meet with Martin Luther. He never personally spoke to him, which is astounding when you think about it. But part of his very shrewd way of dealing with the situation was to always maintain a real objective, kind of arm's-length relationship with Martin Luther personally. It's pretty certain that they exchanged words at the Diet of Worms in 1521 or so, but they never met personally one-on-one like in a private meeting, which is kind of fascinating. So you can say, what kind of relationship did they have? Frederick, I spent a good deal of time reading as much of Frederick the Wise's correspondence that's been translated. In his letters, it's very clear. He says over and over to people who demand he do something about Luther, he says the same things for years over and over. He keeps saying, I want to make sure that this is all treated fairly, that this is judged independently, that scholars really have a chance to discuss these things. He never gave in to demands to turn Luther over. He kept insisting that he be judged in Germany by Germans or by qualified theologians. Very careful diplomacy. He always kind of said, well, of course, I personally have no, I'm not qualified to give an opinion on the merits of Luther's case, but I do want to protect his right to express himself as a teacher of the church, and I will offer him my protection. Even that was very dangerous, but Frederick knew exactly what he was doing.
One would think, being a devout Roman Catholic, being a man devoted to the piety of the day in connection with those relics and things like that, that he would not have sympathy for this upstart pope, but this upstart monk in his territory. But he appears to have that sympathy. And in addition to what you just described there, kind of the impartiality of a wise ruler, to what degree did he, or how do we know to what degree he might have theologically sympathized with Luther's cause?
Well, it's interesting how scholars, many scholars, just like to dismiss Frederick the Wise's personal sympathies towards Luther, or to say, well, he was always Roman Catholic, he never really agreed with Martin Luther. I believe that's complete nonsense. Several pieces of evidence. First of all, he surrounded himself with Lutherans. In fact, when you read the early correspondence from Roman Catholic sympathizers, they're the ones who first start using the word Lutherans. And in many letters from the Pope's nuncios and representatives, they write back to cardinals and the Pope in Rome himself, and they say flat out, Frederick is surrounded by Lutherans. He had Georg Spalatin, who was Luther's lifelong close friend, as his secretary for years. His brother, John the Steadfast, was obviously very sympathetic towards Luther and kept encouraging Frederick the Wise. In fact, I dug it out again in preparation for the show, but I remembered reading this collection of correspondence, and I have two wonderful examples where Frederick forwards. He always would forward to his brother John and to his nephew John Frederick, whom he referred to as my beloved son. He would always forward anything Luther wrote immediately. He would always say, here's the latest from Luther. I know you're going to like this. In one of the letters, he says, here is Luther's latest document. It contains, quote, many wonderful things. And elsewhere, he kind of talks about being, kind of kids about him being, himself being a heretic for protecting Luther. It's manifestly clear to me that Frederick was in great sympathy with Luther. I believe, first of all, because he was intrigued that Luther was bucking the entire doctrinal system of the Roman Church and the whole academic tradition of the Roman Church, which was rooted in scholasticism, heavily founded in Greek philosophy. And Frederick was a lover of the arts and of humanism. And his close association with this circle of people and influenced by these circles of people, he was talked into bringing Luther aboard in Wittenberg as one of these bright, young, growing scholars. And then he also paid for Philip Melanchthon to come to the University of Wittenberg. So Frederick was very wise, very cautious, very careful. He never just said, I agree with Martin Luther, unlike his brother John, and then, of course, John Frederick the Magnanimous was the most outspokenly partisan of the bunch, frankly. But it's simply, in my opinion, nonsense to suggest Frederick personally didn't sympathize and agree with Luther. And I'll give you another piece of great evidence. In 1522, he stopped exhibiting his relics. Now imagine that, Todd. Can you imagine the amount of money he poured into collecting these things? I mean, millions of dollars, millions of dollars. But by 1522, he stopped putting them on display. At his death, they were all gathered together and sent to Torgau, where they were dismantled by jewelers, the reliquaries. That's a remarkable testimony to where he was at. And then on his deathbed, he received Holy Communion for the last time under the form of both bread and wine, which was a huge symbol that he had embraced the Reformation.
I mean, that final thing is an absolute clincher, because for him to have done that was a very subtle to us, but not so subtle signal to the rest of the world.
No, that was like he was finally free, literally on his deathbed, finally free to completely say, here I stand. But until that point, I do not criticize or fault him for the very cautious and guarded way he acted publicly. It literally saved Martin Luther's life several times.
Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. It's Issues Etc. Reformation Week. We're in Luther's inner circle talking about his three princes, Frederick the Wise, John Frederick, and we'll talk a little bit more about Frederick the Wise on the other side of the break. Also, John the Steadfast. We'll be right back.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. Issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
I'm Pastor Watson. Are you tired of entertainment and in need of the peace that passes human understanding? I invite you to Augsburg Lutheran Church in Shawnee, Kansas to receive the gifts of Jesus. Augsburg is scriptural, traditional, historical, sacramental, and reverent. The Church of the Apostles, the Councils, and the Reformers wants to be your church family also. For more information, visit us at augsburglutheranchurch.org.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. We're talking about Luther's inner circle, talking about Frederick the Wise, John the Steadfast, and John Frederick, the princes of Saxony, when Luther was undertaking the Reformation. Paul, let's talk a little bit about some of that political intrigue, especially as it involved Frederick the Wise. You're talking about how well-placed he was politically. But from their side, the emperor and the powers that be at the time were really trying to woo Frederick the Wise, weren't they?
Well, the most dramatic example of this, and again, in this correspondence, I read the letter that the Pope sent to Frederick the Wise, along with his representative, Miltitz, his name was, who was sent to visit Frederick and give him the Golden Rose, which was an annual gift to a faithful ruler and leader in the church. And this letter from the Pope to Frederick just gushes on. My dear son in the faith, your fame as a faithful servant of the church and true son of the church precedes you, blah, 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 blah. What's going on at the time is the Pope's trying to woo Frederick to support his choice for the next emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So many things came together perfectly for Martin Luther. There was all this political intrigue as to who would be the next emperor. Maximilian had died, and some people wanted Charles V. Other people wanted Francis I of France. The Pope kind of went back and forth. He just wanted somebody he thought would be a defender of the Papal States and the Pope himself, because they were under constant military threat from others. All this was whirling around, and then on the other side of the spectrum was the Turks were threatening Europe continually through this period. So it was always, I want to keep the Lutherans on my side politically and militarily, so they'll contribute troops to fight off the Turks, which are coming closer and closer. They went all the way to the gates of Vienna. You know, I mean, that's very scary. But Frederick knew exactly how to play this whole system very delicately, and his responses are always very respectful and careful. And again, he always falls back on, well, I'm in no position to judge. I'm not a theologian. But it just seems to me that this bright professor and all his views, you know, just on and on. And there's so many examples of this. He fought to have Luther heard first in Germany by Cardinal Cajetan. The first thing that happened was Luther was summoned to Rome. Frederick said, well, no, you know, I think he needs to be heard here. And then even the Diet of Worms in 1520, after things had really gotten out of hand, was frankly going to bring Luther down and sentence him and send him on for execution. But Frederick insisted on a protective situation for him, that he would be protected as he journeyed to the city of Worms, that he would be allowed to leave peacefully. And then Frederick took Luther under his personal protection at the castle Wartburg in Eisenach, Germany, for a period of time, and nobody knew where Luther was. The rumors were that he had been kidnapped, perhaps even killed, but Frederick had him taken into protective custody to save his life again. So when Frederick literally saved Luther's life, probably three, four separate occasions, where if he would have caved in at various points, he would have just shipped him right off to Rome. And the famous one of the comments made in some of the correspondence was, Rome doesn't interview people, they execute heretics.
How does it go from then Frederick the Wise to John the Steadfast? Is it simply the death of Frederick the Wise and things transfer?
Yeah, this is good to talk now about John. Frederick and John were very close. John was 5 years younger than Frederick. They were very close as brothers. This was not always the case in these political situations where one brother would be jealous of the one who had received the inheritance and so on. But these two were extremely close. It is said that Frederick never made any major decisions without consulting with his brother John and vice versa. So when Frederick died in 1525, he was buried in the castle church in Wittenberg, and his grave is there still to this day with his beautiful bronze plaque over the whole thing, kind of recounting his whole life, and he's right there in front of the main altar. And so John took over in 1525, and it was thrust upon John at that point that he now would be kind of the heir apparent to the whole Reformation. John had been won over to the Reformation very early on, and John was in a position to be a much more vocal advocate for Luther, and in his correspondence with Frederick is constantly commending Luther and praising Luther and thanking his brother for protecting Luther. It's very one-sided. You know, John was much more free to speak. For instance, John became elector in 1525, and he refused to publish the papal bull against Luther. Frederick had allowed him to be in charge of whether or not that was going to happen, and he did not allow that to be published. He was constantly advocating for Luther with Frederick, as I said. And here's an interesting thing to show how close Luther was to John. John asked, basically begged Luther to send him every single page of the Bible as it was translated and printed, and Luther did that very dutifully. So John the Steadfast was a voracious reader of the scriptures and just ate up anything Luther wrote and sent to him. Very strong advocate for Luther.
He carries on Frederick the Wise's legacy, but then obviously not threading the needle the way that, at least politically, Frederick was attempting to do. What more can you tell us about John the Steadfast?
Yeah, by the time he took over, things were very much pretty much set in stone. Everybody knew that there was just no hope for any kind of a compromise on the part of the evangelicals, as they called themselves, or the Lutherans, as their enemies called them. He not only took over Electoral Saxony in May 1525, but he also became the de facto head of all the evangelical princes. And that happened around February 1526. And several things he did, as you said, there was no more threading of the needle. It was just outright, no, we're not going to do this. When they were summoned to the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, for instance, the very first thing that happened was Charles V called all the princes together and ordered them, forbid them, to have any Lutheran preaching while they were there. And John just said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to hear our preachers. We're not going to forbid them to preach. He was instrumental in leading up to and founding the Small Called League, so on and so forth. And he really shined at the Diet of Augsburg when the Augsburg Confession was presented. Luther wrote of him that he was a shining example of faithfulness. Luther gushed on about how openly he advocated for the gospel, and he refused to compromise. That's why he was called John the Steadfast or John the Constant. He just hung in there and did not give in to any demands to compromise or any demands to abandon the evangelical faith, but he remained very, very faithful. And this was a very sincere thing on his part. You know, a lot of modern scholars today like to try to put themselves in this position of, you know, this objective evaluation of people and almost kind of a disdain for these quote-unquote naive people. These people were extremely wealthy, extremely powerful, much more so than even our modern politicians in a democracy. They had all this power and all this wealth. They could have done anything they wanted to do. But instead, a man like John the Steadfast and his brother before him chose to defend Luther and stand up against the Emperor Charles, who was an advocate for Roman Catholicism, and, of course, against the Pope himself.
His signature leads the princes who signed the Augsburg Confession, and I noticed that John the Magnanimous is in there as well.
Yes.
What did it mean for this man, John the Steadfast? And then we will talk about John the Magnanimous a little bit in a moment. What did it mean for them to put their signatures on the Augsburg Confession?
Well, honestly, perhaps an easy way to understand it is exactly how the signers of the American Declaration of Independence did what they did. They understood they were literally putting their lives on the line when they stood up against the British Empire. And so also these Lutheran princes realized that they too were putting themselves at great jeopardy by refusing to give in to the demands to stop this movement, to stop the Reformation. I don't think anybody at the time referred to it as the Reformation, even though you do find that word used in various places. But they just most often would say, we will not forbid the preaching of God's word purely. We will not forbid our evangelical preachers. They referred to themselves and their preachers as evangelicals, which of course means gospel. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew what was at stake. I mean, Luther's, you know, great hymn of the Reformation, take they our life, goods, fame, you know, let these all be gone. They yet have nothing won. The kingdom ours remaineth. These men lived those words. They were the ones who really had the biggest skin in the game and had the most to lose. And as we'll talk about in a minute, John Frederick really paid the price for this.
Pastor Paul McCain is publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. We're in Issues Etc. Reformation Week, Luther's Inner Circle, and we're talking about his Princes. He's also general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Thanks to Terry in New Braunfels, Texas, for joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club this month. She'll be receiving the limited edition Here I Stand long-sleeve t-shirt, along with the other membership benefits. You can find out how you can stand with us by becoming an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron by clicking the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses at IssuesETC.org. You can also join the Reformation Club by check. Just make your check payable to Issues Etc. Send it to Issues Etc. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Be sure to write Here I Stand shirt and your shirt size on the memo line of your check. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. When we come back, we've talked about Frederick the Wise and we've talked about John the Steadfast. The next one will be John the Magnanimous. Why is he called that? We'll be right back.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Christians young and old are increasingly pressured to change their beliefs. That's why St. Jude said we need to contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. At the San Antonio Worldview Conference, Confessional Lutherans Jonathan Fisk, Jay Weber, Ryan McPherson, and Craig Parton will unmask the false, direct us to Christ and His Word, and defend the faith. The San Antonio Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 11th, San Antonio, Texas. Visit worldviewsa.org. worldviewsa.org.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
My Lord, greetings from our Most Holy Father. As for me, I'm especially honored to meet you, as all of Christendom knows of your steadfast devotion to the faith. I have brought you a gift from our Holy Father to express his highest esteem for your lordship. For, as you know, my lord, this most sacred rose is consecrated annually by Pope Leo himself and sent to just one favored prince in recognition of heroic loyalty and devotion to Christ's Holy Church.
Ah, this fellow's in. I'm sorry for keeping you so late, but this is a matter of some urgency. First of all, give Miltitz 600 ducats as an expression of our gratitude.
My lord, the rose is hardly worth so much.
Oh, I know that. And then tell them that we will not deliver Luther to Rome. And get that rose, put it among the relics. And while you're about it, move all the relics out. Move them to some place that I don't even know where they are. I don't want to know where they are. I want to see them go on.
That's a clip from the 2003 Luther movie, Frederick the Wise being wooed by the papal delegate and also deciding in the end that he will not give Luther over into the Pope's hands. He doesn't even want anything to do with his vast reliquary and the collection that he had spent a lifetime assembling. We're talking about Frederick the Wise, John the Steadfast, and turning to John Frederick, Luther's Inner Circle, This Issues, Etc. Reformation Week. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House. So, Paul, we've talked about Frederick the Wise and then John the Steadfast, these honorifics that the men obviously deserved in a human sense. Why John the Magnanimous?
Well, the German word Großmütiger could mean generous as well. I should mention John the Steadfast died in 1532. And at that point, John Friedrich, it's Johannes Friedrich in German, or John Frederick. They all had common names. It gets confusing. He took over. And it's kind of a touching story, actually, of what happened to his mother. John the Steadfast had married Sophie of Mecklenburg, and 3 years later, they had one son, and his name, of course, was John Frederick. She died just a little less than 2 weeks after giving birth to her only son, John, and John the Steadfast was absolutely crushed emotionally, and his brother helped him set up and pay for an endowed altar. And again, this is early on. They were still Roman Catholic in sympathy and belief, to build this separate altar in the church in Torgau, St. Mary's, which is literally just outside the big castle gates of the castle in Torgau. And to this day, you can see her grave. It's a beautiful, beautiful grave, and there's a Cronach painting there. So John Friedrich basically was raised without ever knowing his mother, but he was taken under the wing of George Spalatin, who was Luther's, again, lifelong best friend, John Frederick the Wise's secretary. He was loved by his uncle, Frederick the Wise, and who, as I said before, referred to him often in correspondence as my beloved son. He considered John Frederick his son as well, as much as John's. And he was raised as a child in the Lutheran faith. And he was so generous with his time, with his money, with his influence, with his power. I like John Frederick the Magnanimous. If I had to choose of the three and say who's my favorite, that's a tough question. But this guy was amazing. First of all, he was larger than life. He ate too much. He drank too much sometimes. He was profoundly faithful to his wife and children, which was not always the case in those days. In fact, most rulers had mistresses. John Frederick did not. He poured his heart into all of this. I have to say, he also kind of is a guy after my own heart because he was a huge book collector and lover. He had one of the largest libraries in Germany. In fact, I just discovered on the internet, they've digitized almost the entire personal library of John Friedrich the Magnanimous. And you see this incredible book collection he had. Just he read voraciously. He was very smart. He had a lot of knowledge. Sometimes he wasn't always as shrewd as his uncle. He sometimes blundered in the situations. But he immediately picked up he grabbed the baton from his uncle, and he just kept charging forward, defending Luther constantly.
You talk about kind of his excesses, and he was kind of outspoken if he'd had too much wine to drink or something like that, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think these things always get blown out of proportion. In those days, and the wealthy would eat these huge meals. John Frederick was huge. He was a big fat guy. You can see in the contemporary paintings. In fact, I saw his, when I went to Germany once, I just stumbled into this incredible, as it was described to me, once-in-a-lifetime exhibit of period artifacts, and one of them was his suit of armor that he had on at the Battle of Muhlenberg in 1547, and the armor for his horse. First of all, his horse was huge, and his armor was huge, because he was just a big, fat guy. He died when he was 51 years old, and I can't help but think maybe he just kind of overdid it. But again, he was a very loving man, very gregarious. And yeah, sometimes he would just not be as cautious as would probably have been expected of a prince. He just said what was on his mind. He didn't always listen to Luther's advice. One case that sticks out in my mind. Luther advised him not to remove a Roman Catholic bishop from the city of Naumburg, but he just charged ahead and kicked the guy out, and he had Nicholas Amsdorf installed as bishop, and Luther actually consecrated Amsdorf as bishop. That was the first and last Lutheran bishop in Germany. Didn't work out too well. So he did all kinds of things. One of the interesting things he did, he personally oversaw the construction of what arguably and probably truly can be described as the first Lutheran church building. He had built into one of the sections of the Torgau Castle this beautiful chapel, and at its time, the chapel interior was covered with paintings by Lucas Cranach. Can you imagine that? And throughout the whole castle, he had Cranach paint all over the place, but he brought Luther down in 1544, just 2 years before Luther died, to consecrate the chapel and to preach the very first sermon there. And they would go to church every single day when he was in residence at that castle. So very, very pious man, very gregarious man, very bold man. So I've got a bit more to say, but go ahead, Todd.
Well, he also, as I mentioned before, signed the Augsburg Confession. And right. He, along, I guess that would have been with his father.
Yes.
So father and son there, this had to say something to the political powers of the day, that if now the ruling prince and then his inevitable successor were both signing this,
yeah,
Lutheranism perhaps was here to stay.
That's a very good point. He was 23 years old at the Diet of Augsburg. He was there. He witnessed everything. He signed it with his father. So there was no question whatsoever what was going to happen after John the Steadfast died. In fact, when he did die, John Frederick took over in 1532 and was kind of co-ruler with his brother-in-law, John Ernst. When his mother died, his father, John the Constant, remarried. John Ernst was the first son of that marriage. But then he became sole ruler in 1542. Couple other things about him. He was known to be very impulsive. He wasn't very far-sighted. Luther really felt free to give John Frederick advice whether he wanted it or not. You see a distinct change in tone in how Luther wrote and spoke to John Frederick as opposed to how he wrote and spoke, particularly to Frederick the Wise, extremely deferential. But then with John the Constant, much more warm and personal. But then with John Frederick, he talked to him like a father would talk to a son. And John Frederick regarded himself as a spiritual son of Martin Luther.
So they actually, unlike Frederick the Wise, they actually had what we would call today a personal relationship.
Oh, but yes, they really did. It was very strong. It was very close. John was forever asking Luther for advice on this, that, and another thing. You know, Luther himself was not he grew to be a good politician, but Luther himself was not the greatest politician either. I mean, he couldn't hold a candle to Frederick the Wise, but John Frederick would look to Luther for advice on how to govern the church, all kinds of matters of casuistry, we call it, things that come up that have no crystal clear answer in the Bible. There's tons of correspondence between them.
You mentioned, I think, before the Small Caldic League. Just give us the historian's thumbnail sketch of what that was, and then John Frederick's involvement.
Well, very quickly, the Small Caldic League was formed as a response to the growing desire on the part of the Roman Catholic Emperor Charles V and those princes that were sympathetic and agreed with him to basically destroy the Reformation. So the Small Caldic League was a political and military alliance, because in those days, you know, as we would say today, church and state were not separate. So it was very common to go to war over religion, and when you went to war over religion, it also involved political influence and territory and power and, you know, basically nation building. So they allied themselves to protect each other. It was kind of almost like a United Nations sort of situation, a mutual protection society. But John the Frederick led that. In 1547, he insisted Luther write a document to be used at what was supposed to have been a Roman Catholic Council of the whole church, which never took place until the Council of Trent later, actually. But he was very instrumental in having Luther do this, even though he personally didn't want to have anything to do with it. John Frederick was very skeptical and just said, nothing will come of this. But in 1537, he had Luther draft what became known as the Small Call Articles, which are in the Book of Concord to this day.
He went to war in 1546, the Small Caldic War, and am I right here, was taken prisoner in one of the battles?
Yeah, he. This was really a very remarkable incident. Finally, Charles V decided enough is enough. Charles V had been tracking with Luther his whole life. You can just imagine he finally said, okay, enough of this. Now I've got the time and the energy and the wherewithal to do something about it. So he basically went to war with the Lutheran princes. John Frederick was on his way into battle, but then a horrible situation happened. He was betrayed by his cousin, Moritz, who sided with Charles V, and they met on the battlefield in Muhlberg in 1547. And John Frederick, in the course of this battle, we don't know what happened or how it happened, but he received a very vicious gash extending from the corner of his left eye all the way down his cheek. And in any painting of him after this event, you see this horrific scar. And he was taken prisoner with Philip of Hesse and taken into custody. And it was so serious. He was, you know, taken in battle on April 24th, 1547. He was imprisoned, and then he was sentenced to death on May 10th, 1547. So very quickly, within a couple of weeks, he had a death sentence on his head. And at that point, he literally lost everything. He lost the entire area of Electoral Saxony. He lost all the castles in his kingdom, everything. He was sent into exile. They kept ratcheting up the pressure on him. They kept demanding he compromise, that he renounce his Lutheran faith, that he embrace all these compromises with Rome. And John Frederick was the only one. Philip of Hesse finally caved in. But John Frederick never compromised. He never gave in. In fact, the account is that when he heard the death sentence, he was in the middle of a chess game, and he heard it very calmly, and he acknowledged it, and then he turned to the guy he was playing with and said, I believe it's your move now. And, I mean, yeah, things went so far, they took away the right of his family to visit him. They took away the Bible. They took away anything he was reading. They kept putting all this pressure on him. He was finally released from prison. He wasn't actually in a prison, but he was, you know, imprisoned. And he was then sent into exile and wound up in the city of Weimar, Germany, where he and his wife are both buried, by the way, in the city church there in front of this beautiful painting that the Lucas and his son, Lucas the Younger, did together. But he lost everything. He lost absolutely everything, but he did not lose the faith, and he did not lose Christ, and that's what sustained him. And every description of him said he remained constantly cheerful and always had a big grin, you know, smile on his face, and was generally in a good mood all the time, even in these terrible situations. He was a very devout Lutheran Christian.
Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. We're talking about Luther's Inner Circle, Its Issues, Etc., Reformation Week on this Thursday afternoon, October the 27th. When we come back, do we see in these three an ascending public devotion, descending degree of public devotion to the Reformation?
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you looking for Christmas cards that combine beautiful art with a clear Christian confession? Emmanuel Press offers Christ-centered, affordable cards in a variety of designs. You'll find cards with stained glass, illumination, German frescoes, and other unique artwork found only at Emmanuel Press. Visit their website, emmanuelpress.us, E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L, press.us. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Paul McCain is our guest. He joins us for Issues, Etc. Reformation Week. We're talking about Luther's Inner Circle. Today, it's the three princes, Frederick the Wise, John the Steadfast, and John the Magnanimous. So we have these three, Paul. And is it a good thing to say, perhaps a good summary to say, who are there in an ascending degree of public devotion to the Reformation?
That's very well said. That's very well said. You've got basically Frederick, who was in it at the beginning and was not at all sympathetic, became sympathetic, defended Luther. You've got John the Constant, who really was convinced and defended the Reformation of the Diet of Augsburg. And then you've got the full-blown, you know, Lutheran from his youth, John Frederick, who was just unabashedly Lutheran and just no holds barred. He would resist any attempt to compromise with Rome.
Do you think that these men were aware of what was happening under their princely noses, so to speak? Were they aware of their role here in the Reformation, for not only for Luther, but for the ongoing Reformation?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure anybody living in the moment of an event is completely aware of what implications it will have for history. But they were very aware of how dramatically they were taking a stand against the Roman Catholic Church. You know, hindsight being 20/20, we look back now and realize without these three faithful laymen, the Reformation, from a human perspective, simply would not have succeeded. It would not have worked out. And this was true after these men died. There were a whole series of incidents involving faithful Lutheran rulers. For instance, Gustavus Adolphus from Sweden, who basically came in and saved Lutheranism during the 30 Years' War. Another great hero of the faith, another, you know, very much of a human person with faults and failings, but a devout Lutheran. So, you know, just like in the Bible, we look back on these events and we can see how God worked through situations and worked in spite of human frailty and with the gifts he had given to these various people to make sure the gospel continued. You know, that's our comfort, that the gospel will always continue no matter what happens. Christ always finds a way. And in this case, he found a way through three very faithful laymen.
I want you to talk about the courage on both sides of this, because Luther and the other reformers had absolutely no way of looking ahead and knowing whether or not the things that they were doing, what they were writing, what they were preaching, would have any political support from their princes, much less for more than, you know, one term of office, as we would say. So talk briefly about the courage that it took to move forward when you didn't know for sure whether the prince was going to be on your side at first.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Luther particularly inspired these men with his own example. Luther was just reckless in his writings, frankly, and he would gently be chided from time to time by Frederick, particularly. John the Constant would sometimes ask him to tone it down a little bit. Luther was just almost infuriatingly naive about things at first. He had no personal knowledge of the fact that the Pope had worked out an arrangement with the local Roman Catholic bishop to pay for more positions in the church and started this whole indulgence sale going. Luther was not aware of all these financial machinations. So when he started blasting out against indulgences, he was shaking basically the whole financial institutions of Europe to their core because of these vast sums of money changing hands all over the place with indulgences. So Luther just kind of plowed ahead, and you read his early documents where he just, you know, makes these horrendous assertions against the Pope. At first, he even assumed the Pope didn't even realize. So he set the standard for courage. And these men, in their own ways, and particularly Frederick the Wise, he understood that it takes a little finesse. You have to be very careful. You know, politics is the art of the possible, as the old saying goes. And nobody understood that better than Frederick the Wise. And he used that to full advantage everywhere he could with his gentle kind of passive-aggressive resistance against any effort to take Luther. He just was constantly coming to Luther's rescue.
There also seems to be, we'll just speak of it as providence, a providential indication here to me that when Luther needed a perhaps more publicly neutral but very, very powerful ally, he had one in Frederick the Wise. When the Reformation needed a staunch confessor to defend the beginnings of the Lutheran faith, they had it in John the Steadfast. And when they needed someone who was willing to kind of, maybe even as you said before, impulsively, but take up arms to protect Lutheran and Lutheran preaching, they had it in John Frederick.
Yeah, it's like God allowed things to happen in such a way that Luther was always being given time. This process was always in some way being given more time. So Frederick was there when it began, John was there when it took root, and John the Frederick was on the scene when it really began to take stronghold and really spread. And that's why after Luther's death, when things kind of went higgledy-piggledy and people were confused about things, there was yet more examples of God's providential care for the Reformation. And finally, they saw their way through to proper confession in the Book of Concord. So you're right. It's a It really is amazing. It really is amazing to consider how God worked through these three men and through all these situations to advance the cause of the gospel.
Well, I like the way you put it. God was always giving Luther time. Is there a lesson for us today? The descendants, theological descendants of Luther, that while our patience may run out, God is also giving us time for the proclamation of the gospel.
Yes, and I don't know. For me, as I get older, when you're younger, you think that everything depends on you, and you've got to personally do something. You've got to, take the bull by the horns and make people believe or agree or follow what you're trying to do. And you just come to a point like Luther finally did, when he just sat back and said, "Hey, the Reformation happened. The gospel was preached. God's word did it all. I was just, sitting in Wittenberg with my friends drinking good Wittenberg beer, and the word did it all. The word did it all." In fact, the motto of the Reformation, which these three rulers embraced as their own mottos, particularly John the Constant and John Frederick, is "The word of the Lord endures forever," VDMA, from the Latin verbum domini monet in aeternum. And they had that sewn under their clothing. And that's a very bold confession of the fact that we rely completely on God and His word to do what it promises to do. How it happens, when it happens, that's not for us to say. We simply teach it and preach it and live it and let things progress as they may according to God's will.
Pastor Paul McCain is publisher and executive director of editorial for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. He's also general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Paul, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Todd. God bless.
By the way, if you're interested in looking into more deeply the life of Frederick the Wise, that fascinating first prince of Luther's, there's a great resource called Frederick the Wise, Seen and Unseen Lives of Martin Luther's Protector. You could find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the resource Frederick the Wise, Seen and Unseen Lives of Martin Luther's Protector. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., Issues Etc. Reformation Week concludes. We'll be discussing Katrina von Bora, that's Luther's wife, a fascinating story, with the preeminent Luther scholar, Dr. Martin Troy. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.